This is a Shift Podcast Network production.
So, welcome, guys, girls, days, to a very exciting episode of Casablanca. This is why it's exciting, of The Last One to See, because we're talking about Casablanca. So, I've been thinking about this. I love this film, as you will witness. I really want David to have a passion film. I think you need a passion film. I think you're overdue. There's some that you've known more about than me and vice versa. And there's some we've been on the track with together.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure you've had like a passion one.
Donnie Darko would have been pretty high up there for me. I think that was when you go into the depths of how much I had the memorabilia and real collector's itemy approach to it.
And I think with that one, actually, I wasn't as far, like, I loved that film and had seen it at a similar time in my life or whatever. Whereas Casablanca, you initially thought you had seen, and then as you sat down to rewatch it, you were like, no, I haven't actually seen that film. So I think you could say level of knowledge not strong if you couldn't remember that you've seen it.
It was literally like from the culture, it turns out that was what I had picked up. And there is a lot, like Casablanca has permeated everywhere. So it was a great one to come back and look at it from that perspective.
I am very jealous of anyone who did it for their leaving also, because apparently that has happened.
Room with a View was my movie.
I have never seen that. Mine was Cinema Paradiso, which was gorgeous.
You got the better one of the pair, definitely.
And then Of Mice and Men, banger. I've actually never seen a film or play version of it. I've only read the book.
Of Mice and Men, I saw in New York a couple of years ago, the production with James Franco, Chris O'Dowd, and Leighton Meester. What a combo.
Oh, amazing. And also very celeb-studded. We were just talking, listeners, off mic, that me and my parents are going to see the now Olivier-winning Paul Mescal in A Streetcar Named Desire. Mammy Mac is absolutely convinced we're going to get an understudy. And if we do, we'll go with God. But Paul, if you and your beautiful thighs that have once again been gracing the internet could definitely perform on April 29th, 28th, Friday, that would be great.
Well, now, speaking of special guests and important people, we have a very important person as our guest on this episode. Pod Dad himself, Andy Gaffney.
Yeah, and like, it's actually insane that it's taken, because we spend a phenomenal amount of time talking about films off mic, and most of that is with Andy, either in person or in our text group. I don't know why it took us this long to actually ask him. And then, as mentioned, I was absolutely thrilled with the choice because it meant that I got to talk about Casablanca. I'm pretty sure I went into orbit at some point during this. It's a film I love. It's a period of cinema that's interesting.
So will we dive straight into it?
Yes, 100%.
Lovely. So we have Pod Dad finally making an appearance on the microphone. Andy Gaffney, welcome.
It's very near Mother's Day, but this feels like Father's Day.
Yes, it's
because
true.
Because I'm here with my two podcasts.
The velvet hand in the velvet glove. The world's biggest Cameron Crowe fan. But that is not a film that you haven't seen, because I assume you have seen all of Cameron Crowe's films.
I have. Yeah. There's some that are more equal than others. Like, I'm never going to watch something like Singles again, because it's the grunge, and I'm not really a grunge person.
You're saying like it's a foreign word as well. So I think, I'm very uncomfortable with this. Am I pronouncing
grunge
it
like
correctly?
I say lunge, because you nearly have to put the action into it.
Like, I want Buying a Zoo, I want Sigur Rós, I want Sadness, I want a little kid being adorable. That's the Cameron Crowe I want.
We bought a zoo on New Year's Day after a New Year's Eve / my friend Gara's 30th combination, which was where the bus driver dropped us off at like 7 o'clock and was like, I'll be back at 3 a.m. And I was like, Christ. And then all of a sudden it was 3 a.m. It was sort of one of those nights. So we were all in this Airbnb. It was an Airbnb, I think, but it was a kind word, and it had like one couch or something. It was like this cottage in the middle of the country. And we were all like on this one couch, slightly worse for wear, watching We Bought a Zoo. So I think that's kind of the sweet spot of those films.
It sounds like the greatest holiday.
It was
of all time.
A party. Like I said, and his family owned a pub. So it was in the family home and the pub. So it was amazing. But that's my main memory of We Bought a Zoo, was like sort of, please don't take this as an insult, Andy, but sort of like the beige comfort food of film.
Look, I'm as beige as anyone can be. I need my Coldplay. I need my zoo. As in buying one. I don't actually like going to the, you know, I don't go to the zoo, but I need
I can also see if you sort of, through some weird, you know, set of circumstances, you suddenly find yourself owning a zoo and you're like, oh, well,
you would make the best of it. Absolutely.
Yeah, I think I would. If I just had Sigur Rós playing in the background.
The sad boy zoo, like Brandon.
If I was to give you both an enclosure to look after, what would you want?
Red pandas for me.
That's a real thinker.
It's like...
Yeah,
I suppose what would you want and what do you think you could do?
I mean, like, you'd be a bit worried about, like, the carnivores, wouldn't you? Like, you know, I feel I would get eaten. I'm very plump and juicy.
Yeah, the penguins feel like an easy one in terms of, like, the feeding. It's just, like, toss them a few fish and it's grand. And there's not really much violence.
And they're really funny and cute. Yeah. And, like, you know, you get the gay penguins who raise the eggs together. And, like, I could be a penguin ally.
Yeah. And Tango Makes Three, the book about that in the New York Zoo, was gifted to my niece as part of my gay agenda a couple of years
ago. That's very cute, because also I'm pretty sure it's on a lot of school districts of Bat. Yeah, there's some lunatic woman who's, like, responsible for a huge number of the requests to ban books for one particular school district. And that was one of them because of the gay agenda. I think there was an article in the New York Times about it recently. Anyway, we've wandered wildly off the point. Andy, what is the film that you are the last one to see?
I am genuinely the last one to see Casablanca in the world. I must be the last person in the history of humanity to see Casablanca. And, like, the weird thing is, and you guys are about to ask me, well, what do you think Casablanca is about? It could be a Jurassic Park sequel, for all I know. I know nothing about it. I don't know genuinely nothing about it. I don't know when it was filmed. I don't know what's the plot of it. I know there's a famous quote somewhere in it.
Do you know if it's in color or black or white?
It's a complete... I know it's in black and white because I've seen, like...
Okay, we got one thing.
I've seen, like, photos of it. And I assume it wasn't filmed in, like, 1981, you know?
Humphrey Bogart wouldn't be looking good in 1981. What I will tell you, and I can make a bet with you now, is you know more of this film than you think you do. Because that was... Firstly, I think you were absolutely not the last person to see Casablanca. I think it would actually be a relatively popular choice.
Yeah, I'd agree. Like, we were chatting about this when you mentioned that your choice was Casablanca. I think I've seen it, but... It is, like, somewhere in the annals of time that, like, I've seen a few films of that black and white. I think it's 30s.
The Kate era that you are very, like, that and Lord of the Rings, you're a bit like, about. Whereas I'm like, those films are my life.
Was it made in the 1930s or 40s?
40s, yeah. I think.
So I think, like, there's film noir and other stuff that I do love from that era that I think have clouded my memory.
That's more 30s, I think, and then this is sort of post.
But it's clouded my memory of Casablanca itself. I'm really, like, there will be
42.
Bits, I'm sure,
sorry, I didn't want... I'm trying also not to give away too much by being like, well, of course it was this time because of this, so you guys need to watch it. But I will say, I will make a bet with you now, there are more quotes in this that you know than you think you do.
I'm assuming, and it's something that we were flirting with before, like, I assume, like every famous film, there's going to be a lot, when I'm watching it, there's going to be a lot of, like, oh, so that's that bit from The Simpsons. So that's that bit from The Simpsons. That's that bit from The Simpsons.
I think there's one whole lift they did, because we are actually currently rewatching early Simpsons. I think there's one whole lift they did. I'm trying to remember what episode it is, but it's not coming to me, of basically the end. There'll be a few bits, but I think it's honestly, like, that the lines are just so iconic that a lot of them are actually used in, like, actual speech and are actual, like, I think obviously there's been, like, loads of references to it in other films and whatever, and I'm sure the Gilmore Girls, like, and that type of thing, like, have definitely referenced it before, but, like, I do think these are actually phrases that we use, which is interesting. You, Andy, looks very skeptical about this.
Well, no, like, I gotta guess, like, is the things that is, I gotta sound so silly here, right? But, like, so things that I'm guessing that are in this film are Play It Again, Sam. Is that Casablanca?
Yes, no. And no.
Oh, God.
Yeah. I will clarify that after you have watched the film, but yeah, strong yes, but no.
And there's, of all, no, this is, of all the gin spots in the world, that line is,
you
that,
are very close, not... yes,
okay,
you are not quite the letter, but certainly the general.
If we were playing darts, you've hit the board, but it's no bullseye. Yeah.
But it happens.
Yeah But no, but that is a lot, you know, I mean, other than Cameron Crowe, you and Cameron Crowe films, Whomst Among Us is word for word for
you. You are always word for word, Kate. You're pulling
I was in the room for both Titanic and Lion King.
Yeah, well, actually, I have very recently watched Titanic. I have very recently watched Casablanca. I think I might have mentioned this on one of our previous episodes. There's a great crowd here in Birmingham called the Wine Events Company. It's very Ron Seal, but what they do is they show films and you get like five glasses of wine throughout it that are, they stop, do a wine tasting that are like connected to the film. So we did the first Lord of the Rings, so it was all like New Zealand wines. And then we, within the past month, it's been a crazy month, what with all the, you know, engagements and proposals. And I went to Rome and then I went to San Sebastian. Side note, amazing. Like, if anyone is looking for a tip where you just have to go from bar to bar eating perfectly sized pieces of delicious food, go to San Sebastian. And if you swim at this time of year, the Spaniards all stare at you while they're in their winter coats going, you fucking lunatics. But yeah, before that, we went to one of the wine tasting screenings for Casablanca. There is one scene that I always cry at. So you guys can guess which afterwards. But yeah, it is actually very top of mind, and it is one of those films. We drive my mother mad because she says the McAvoys can never be together without talking about film within like 5 to 7 minutes. This would be a, and at both my grandparents died within like 10 months of each other, sign of a great love, allegedly. They died in the same year, so we had the parish priest we ended up spending a lot of time with, and it just ended up with him and my uncle talking about Casablanca repeatedly, just at various like wakes and funeral preparations and whatever. So they just, he was like, I keep finding it myself with him and he keeps bringing up Casablanca.
And where did you see it? Like, where did you first, where did someone sit you down and go, tonight, young Kate, we're going to watch Casablanca?
I mean, I'm going to say probably my dad, but like, I can't remember the first time I saw this film, and I've owned it on, and then I can't remember the first time I saw it. Then I think it was on one of my weird videos that I recorded off television, like probably beside Apocalypse Now or something. And then I've had it on DVD for like a really long time. And then, yeah, I feel like I'm really, there will be a lot to talk about, but I'm really throwing all my Casablanca memories out there. So as you guys may remember, we had a lockdown for a good like 2 odd years quite recently. And Steve, said fiance slash partner slash Englishman, was on furlough from Jaguar Land Rover, where he works, because when you can't get car parts from around the world, it's quite difficult to make cars. So he came over to me for 6 weeks. So we did the 2 week quarantine, and not that we were going anywhere after that. And I had just been diagnosed with sarcoidosis, which is this lung condition that I have. I'm completely fine, listeners, after a really long period of steroid use with a face like the moon. I am fine, but I was really quite sick. And also, it's a pulmonary, how it expresses itself in me is my lungs, and, you know, not ideal to have in the middle like of a worldwide illness, pulmonary. Yeah, not ideal. So my parents were absolutely delighted, because I think they had this idea that I'd be like lying on my back, gasping like a turtle. So yeah, Steve came over, stayed for 6 weeks, possibly went back for stone heavier, because the other thing about being on steroids is you are wired to the fucking moon. Now, so I went from the stage where like I genuinely couldn't climb the stairs to go to the loo without taking a break to like making lasagna from scratch at 8 o'clock at night. And, you know, he'd get up, I was working like insane hours as well. So I was doing that while I was on a PPM for the Super Value Christmas ad, the one that, I don't know if you remember, the Is He Coming one, and you think it's going to be Santa and it's his granddad. So that went like insanely viral. I was working on this, like, it was weird because we couldn't leave the house, but like they were writing about this in like New Zealand and New York, so it was a really weird time. But anyway, before Steve went back, we got in a brew and view, a surf and turf from Asador, and we had some really nice wine, and so we had a really nice dinner, and he was like, I want to watch Casablanca. So it was like our last date before, and also like I didn't know when I would see him again as well after that. So yeah, waltzed around the living room after that.
Well, actually, we're in an interesting position in terms of like, we've got someone who's never seen it, someone who vague memories
vaguely
of
may have
seeing it at most, and someone who is
someone who had the most romantic evening of all time.
And it is honestly like part of the reason he watched it is like, it is one of my favorite films, and that's shorter than Sunset Boulevard, and is probably more, it's comfortably more romantic than Sunset Boulevard, but that's like a low bar given.
When Sunset, he was leaving said lockdown visit, this was in Dublin, wasn't it?
Yeah, he came over to Dublin, yeah.
Did he say, we'll always have Dublin, which I think may be in this film?
I mean, yes, it is in the way that you're trying to say it. And ironically, the last time we were together, I'd come over to Birmingham, and it was, as you remember, there was a really weird 3 week period where like you know, we had shut down, people were working from home, whatever. And Boris was like, it's completely fine. I was going around like hugging COVID patients and then like promptly got COVID. So there was this weird 3-week limbo where everything in Ireland had was locking down. And like in the UK, it was like almost aggressively go on as normal. And not that the average person was feeling this way. This was the agenda that was being pushed by their government. And I was due to go over to meet Steve and then go to Paris for the rugby with a bunch of friends. This would have been the year after that I met Steve at a rugby match in Rome, as was mentioned in his proposal. And so I got there and I was like, we're not going, like they're going to cancel it. He's like, what are you talking about? I was like, they're absolutely going to cancel it. And a lot of my mates who live in the UK who are going, they work for multinationals in London, so they'd already been sent home.
I remember actually I was raging because in Ireland, we put the lockdown restrictions ahead of Paddy's Day. So it was obviously like that was the big worry.
Mm, yeah. But
the week after Paddy's Day, I had tickets in London for a West End show that had, I can't even remember the name of it now, but Vanessa Williams of Save the Best for Last fame and Nicola Roberts were two of the cast members.
I was literally about to go Vanessa Redgrave, who,
and it was
which
just
is
like
very different,
1920s, yeah. 1930s kind of film noir-y. Mm. Very much in the vein of Casablanca era musical. Mm. And I was also to see Nadine Coyle play at a gay bar that same week. So I was raging because like the rules had come in that I couldn't leave Ireland to go to London to see the two shows. And I was waiting for them to bring down the restrictions so that I could get a refund on the tickets because I was desperate to go to these. So unfortunately, the musical was never rescheduled, never happened. And then the Nadine show did come much later, but unfortunately I did get my tickets refunded. So my week of Girls Aloud that COVID got in the way of. Wow.
It is just very like, yes, we have a lot of very similar interests, but then also that I would be in Paris at the rugby while you would be seeing Nadine Coyle in a gay bar is also... Yeah,
that's where we fork.
But yeah, so in the end, obviously, for those who may remember, they cancelled that match or whatever. So Steve had never been to Paris and has still never been to Paris. And we're actually due to go in October for my birthday for the World Cup quarterfinals, which Ireland have never made it past the quarterfinals. For that, you're both looking at me going, yes, we're humoring you because we're somehow back talking about sport again. So yeah, that's going to be allegedly Steve's first trip to Paris. So we will always have Paris, but he still hasn't gotten there yet. So fingers crossed, I'll report back in October. Anyway, I think we've covered like a worrying amount of stuff in the intro to this podcast.
But it's all good, lovely stuff. We're getting to see how much it
is a huge
it means to you. So then when I come back in, I'm going like, no, I hated it. Like, yeah. It won't feel too. I genuinely think I'm going to love it because it is. You know, I like to be sad at all times. Not like I'm
well,
very happy.
Do I have a film for you?
Yeah, I'm a very happy guy. But in my movie watching, I like to be. I like to keep a steady, you know, heartbreak.
Like I think you're very much in the ballpark of a lot of stuff. I think you will enjoy this film. To be honest. I think it is hard not to enjoy this film because I think it is very good, but I don't consider that a massive spoiler given it has been very famous for a very long time.
I'm really, 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 really looking forward to it. And it's like, it's one of those things where like my parents never sat me down to go, right, we're watching
your
Casablanca. You know, they would do that for a Bond movie. If a Bond movie was on, we're getting sat down. Or August 16 meant, no, not from my father, but for my mother, August 16 every year was... I don't care what you're doing today. It's August 16, which means Turner Classic Movies are going to show every Elvis movie.
Yeah.
So you're watching every Elvis movie.
Fun interjection. That is my father's birthday. He was 21 when Elvis died.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah. Happy Leo season.
I've seen Kissing Cousins like 3 times. Elvis Presley rom-com Kissing Cousins 3 times. My mother has shown me that, but never once thought, gonna show you Casablanca.
Now that though, like Kate has obviously set the viewing bar very high in terms of like...
I have utter faith in this film, and also you're a sentimental fool, so I think you will get it.
What is your plan for your viewing of it? Are you going to make it a memorable occasion?
Are you going to get a surf and turf and waltz around this? Because like that's very important.
Late night, no laptop on, no nothing, dark, put it on about 11:30. That's the sweet spot. And also, do you know what I've done, which has, I'm going to like fall back on this even by the time we record this in like a few days, but you know what has changed my viewing habits completely? Here's my top tip for anybody is I have got a, now on my little desk over there.
He's frantically pointing at the direction.
I had a thing. I have a contact charger.
Wireless one.
You know what?
Yeah.
Wireless.
Oh, you just put it. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
I'm sure David has like 7 dotted around his
Because I needed it. Because I.
Did you have one here?
I needed it. because I needed a charger. But you know what has done? You know what's been an accidental joy of it is that because there's no wire on it. Okay, that when I put it down, I kind of have to leave it there. I have to, so I don't touch it during the movie. So it's become, I'm rediscovering life at the moment. This is the perfect time.
We get
for
sponsored
me to watch
by
Doesn't
one
like
of these
it.
Companies that make such things in between this and then, because like that's a strong plug.
I have got a new Samsung phone recently, not sponsored, but the...
That'd be great if suddenly we're sponsored by Samsung.
Fingers crossed. But there's a feature on this, I think it's just called like modes, and you're able to program different like phone settings based on contextual stuff. So for the Lighthouse Cinema, when I get within range of it on Google Maps and connect to the Lighthouse Wi-Fi, it automatically puts my phone into like low brightness, turns off the vibrate, like all the settings are like movie ready, literally when I walk into the cinema. And then similarly in the Gaff,
that's quite Skynet-y,
and like
it's scaring
NFC
me.
Stickers. And I just tap the phone against that when I start watching a movie, and again puts it on silent, like does all the things.
There's no frequency in the lighthouse anyway, so you don't, you don't need to be doing it. But like, it's still very impressive, you know.
But it's the ritual of cinema watching. I see the need to just like remove the distractions and.
And like me and Jennifer are currently rewatching all of Fast and Furious at the moment, so you really need to let that. Let those marinate.
Yeah. Well, it's also a film about beautiful friendships, so that's the best I can do to connect those. So,
are you the last one to see the Fast and Furious movies?
I've seen 1 and 2, so I've seen I've seen Tokyo Drift, which I think is the third.
Well, they only get good from 5 on.
Yeah. No, it
I
was.
I
haven't
seen
it either.
Only seen the first one.
Christmas special. Here we go.
Like, we may need to do that as like an out of season. We'll do the whole thing.
No, I've seen because I actually was like, oh, okay, I'm going to watch these. I think around the time of like 8 or something. So I watched 1 and 2, which I think some of 2 I might have already seen, and I have seen Tokyo Drift for some baffling reason.
Did you understand the riveting plot without all the context from the previous ones?
The subtle nuances? Yes, I did. Well, it stars what's his name? Is it Lucas Black? He is, so Friday Night Lights, people obviously mainly know as an extremely successful TV series about Texas high school football that stars Kyle Chandler, whom we love. But it was originally, firstly, it was a book based on a true story that by H.G. Bissinger, written in 1988. But then it was a film with Billy Bob Thornton as the coach. And it's one of my all-time favorite films. It's a much lower key. It has an incredible Explosion of the Sky soundtrack. But the quarterback, Mike Winchell, is played by Lucas Black, who's the star of Tokyo Drift. That doesn't have Paul Walker or Vin Diesel or any of the... I think the guy who's co-stars in it with him then appears in later.
He comes back in, from
in this
5 onwards. And then they play that as a... They're almost prequels to Tokyo Drift. We're doing this. Can we do this? Like, I will... Because I've seen them all 10,000 times. But I will chat to ye as the last ones to see.
We've never had like a spin-off season come out of an episode. But like, let's do it.
It's happening.
We have wandered far from God's light / the film that we are actually watching. I don't know who had a Fast and Furious spin-off mini season on their bingo cards for this podcast intro, but on that note, I think we'll probably have to draw a line under it. And I am also very excited for you to see it. Extremely excited.
I assume it's like a 3-hour yoke, is it?
No.
Oh.
Sorry, I don't want to keep talking about it in case that was very...
It's 4 hours.
It is 5 hours and 27 minutes of good watch.
It's a 1 hour 42. We like that. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's close to a brisk 90-minuter. Like it absolutely zips along. Okay. Because I know obviously one of the things that we do is, and we have touched on this before on the pod with films of that time, is that they do, because you know they didn't have to compete with phones and Samsung chargers and all of these things, like that they do sometimes take a very long time to get anywhere. And also that was sort of the mood and the vibe. But no, it is actually pretty short by the standards of the time, I would say. And I'm excited for you, David, to reconnect with it and be like, no, actually, I haven't seen this. Or maybe
bells
I did.
Will ring or bells will be silent. We'll see.
Bells will remain unrung.
Is that a quote that I don't know from this movie?
That well-known
claim in it.
Basic.
But there is, I am pretty confident The Simpsons did do the end of it But once you see, I know, tell me.
I think I know the end of it. I think that's, you know,
yeah.
That's like saying, you know, that Han, you know, Han is Darth Vader's father. That's completely wrong. Darth Vader is Luke's
temporally
father.
Confusing.
ChatGPT has taken over Andy's brain and it's being out of misinformation.
Yeah. So like, I think I know the ending, but like, that's like I said.
Yeah, know, well, hopefully like, you'll be as close as you were in that Han Solo is Darth Vader's father. And yeah, really looking forward to chatting with you guys again after you have seen this extremely important movie in my life. So please be gentle.
That's it for the preamble. So here is your courtesy warning that we're about to get into spoiler territory.
So welcome back, everybody, to what is undoubtedly Christmas for me, where I get to talk about Casablanca. Truly, to quote another Humphrey Bogart film, the stuff that dreams are made of. So to cut to the chase, Andy, what did you think of this movie?
I loved it. I genuinely, what a treat. What an absolute treat this film is. From like the moment go, I was like, I am absolutely bang into this. And it was a tall order because I know I said on the previewing thing that I was going to do it nice and, you know, nice evening and late night and all this stuff. I watched it the morning after watching 65 Adam Driver v Dinosaurs. So when you've already experienced a cinematic masterpiece, you're thinking like,
how do you top that? Like,
I think moving as far away as possible thematically from it. So for any of our listeners who haven't seen Casablanca, which is nothing to be ashamed of, because I do think it is up there one of those films that will be a high ranker for us, or that people say they have seen or feel they've seen and have never seen and have been pretending that they've seen it for a very long time.
On that note, actually, I think I have to make a confession that in the aforementioned part of the podcast, I did say that I think I've seen it, but don't really have a memory of it. I'm fairly certain now that I had never seen that film before. Like that, the first, I'd say 20 minutes to half an hour, there were scenes that felt familiar. So either I put it on and gave up, or I've seen so many parodies and things or references or photos that I thought I had seen it. But I'm here to say that that was definitely my first time watching Casablanca in full.
I think that is a huge feeling that people would have watching it, being like, this is vaguely familiar. So I think maybe, Andy, if you can just give us like a brief outline of what it's about, and then we might talk about how the vague, unsettling feeling that you have already seen this film.
Yeah. I kind of assumed it was, even though, like I said, that if you ask me what this movie is about, I'm going to genuinely have no clue or no idea. And when I would think of Casablanca, and the vague image I had in my head was the plane at the end and the lion at the end, I assumed this was a 3-hour sprawling epic, you know, all walking through deserts and all
these
things.
You think this is Lawrence of Arabia?
I was getting a kind of that kind of vibe that this movie is on of a bank holiday. This is one of those films that
you clear your day.
Do you know on Easter? You know on Easter when there's nothing, when there used to be nothing on of an Easter, to quote Breida Gaffney, there's only going to be religious movies on today. You know, and even though I didn't think this was a religious film, it's that of that ilk in my head of this is a sprawling epic. And it is not that. It is a very, very contained, based on a play, actually.
An unproduced play, yeah, exactly. Called Everybody Comes to Rick's.
Which is also a good title.
You get that feeling that it obviously has been based on a play, because it's so contained and it's so straightforward. It's a story about consequences, and I'm getting now excited even thinking about it, but I just kind of loved it that much. But like the basic plot, which was the question you asked me. Handsome debonair Rick runs Rick's bar. I gotta now mess this up. And the gentleman, I have the names right here, he gets passes that allow people to pass into Europe. But into his life comes a concentration camp survivor and freedom fighter, might be the right word to use, and his incredibly stunning partner.
I mean, potentially the most beautiful woman ever on screen in that film. Like, she is just stunning.
Like, I actually did a genuine kind of like, oh my God, when this person walked on. And of course, Rick don't want to be given those passes, because there's a bit of history there. And that's where the romance, and that's where the drama. Will Rick's heart be melted? You'll have to find out when you watch Casablanca.
Cool, they should pay you for that. That was, yeah, very tantalizing. So yeah, I think the thing about it is, and I know I said this earlier in the intro, but were you surprised, either of you, by like how much of it you knew, or how much of it was familiar, or of course, how many lines of it that you have heard before, whether in actuality or in parody?
Well, the thing that really surprised me was the most familiar thing straight away, apart from the fact that it starts with a podcast. The most surprising thing to me is Peter Lorre, because I've grown up looking at an animated picture of Peter Lorre, who plays Ugrat in this.
Ugarty.
His face.
I don't know what word you said, but I think his name's Ugarty.
His face was Tiny Toons. It was Looney Tunes. It was Bugs Bunny, that character, to the point of like, I think I've often, possibly back in the drinking days, possibly, like, said more than like, been trying to Google this man's face. Like, you know that thing that was like, did the internet a few years back? Have you ever dreamt of this man? This chap was my version of that. It was like, this face I remember from cartoons.
He is also in the Maltese Falcon, if you do want to check that out as well. And I think he's probably most iconic role is he's a serial killer in M, which would be, yeah, I think probably what, like he did an in that studio system as well. He did an incredible amount of work, because as you say, he has that face and he is one of those faces. And then also he was a refugee, so he also had the mysterious European accent as well. So I think he had the whole package. But so has this actually solved a riddle for you completely?
It absolutely has, to the point of like, I mean, I messaged ye both.
You see, I actually didn't know which, because you just said your man, so I didn't know which of the many male actors in this film that you were referring to.
It's Peter Lorre, and I will send ye the images after, so you could put them up on the social network. But his face was always a terrifying face in Looney Tunes. He was always the kind of the mad scientist. He was always, and he always had that exact voice. And I assumed it was based on an actor somewhere, but I'd never seen this. Well, if I had, it hadn't landed. But when I just was sitting down and watching it, and I have his face here right beside me right now, and it's genuinely causing me chills here, because he terrified me. That character, his animated form, scared me so much, because I've said this many times before, that I had a Betamax and a Bush television in my bedroom as a child. And I just had, like, the parents just give me tapes after tapes after tapes after tapes that they would just be getting from video shops. There was always Looney Tunes box set. So I just would watch hours and hours and hours and hours.
A true education.
And his face.
I feel Looney Tunes is due, like, a renaissance. And especially, as you say, it's something, like, firstly, it's insane, the stuff that's in there for a kid's show. But also, it is so incredibly, even leaving aside the, like, sometimes it gets incredibly adult. But it's just so incredibly steeped in pop culture references, almost like layered on top of each other.
Yeah, that, the Barber of Seville one is, like, etched into my brain. And the what's the spear and magic helm?
that's the opera one.
Like, I don't know how, like, as a kid watching them and like what they're based on and everything, it really was an education.
Yeah, I think I have "Okay, lady, love you, bye-bye" in my head for the rest of my life.
And I think yeah, because he, like I said, he was always a scientist, but he was always terrifying. Yeah. And they really, like, maybe this man loved it, maybe he was long past, I don't know.
Well, I think, like I said, his breakthrough role was as a psychopathic child killer, so I think he figured out pretty early on that with the face he had and the physique he had, that you were going to be leaning towards a certain type of role. Like, he would never have been Rick, and he would never have been Victor Laszlo, who is the resistance hero. So basically, the way it worked is there was a very convoluted refugee trail to try and get out of war-torn Europe and to the promised land of America. And Casablanca was, almost was the last stop before you could get to America or get to Portugal to get to America. And it was in, it wasn't occupied, but it was under the control of the Vichy French, which is the puppet regime of the Nazis. So the Nazis occupied Paris, where part of this film is set. But then it was this, and you see, the army character kind of trying to play all sides and as well as getting to have it off with beautiful young things. So you have like that you have the Nazis visiting, trying to track down, as you said, these stolen letters of transit, because Ugarte, the world's creepiest man, played by Peter Law of Looney Tunes, Tiny
My
Animaniacs
nightmares.
Fame, has killed some couriers and taken these letters, and he takes them to the one person that he can trust because he knows he doesn't like him to hide, and that is Rick. So everyone is looking for these letters of transit to try and get out of Casablanca, and the person who really wants, who the people who really want them most of all are Victor Laszlo, played by Paul Heinrich. I'm not 100% pronouncing that properly, because as you say, he is a resistance hero, he's a concentration camp escapee. And there is this like insane amount of politeness, because he's coming face to face with the Nazis. And you know, maybe it's a pre-Patriot Act world, because it is this weird no man's land of Vichy France. Whereas if they got him back to France, they would arrest him and take him back to a concentration camp or whatever. So there is this incredible like politeness in all the interactions, if that makes sense.
That's something that actually I found really, really surprising. And I just really was just how much respect there was between everyone and how much they got along. And I know, you know, Rick is quite a, and you know, it's all part of the plot, but he's a bastard for
a
lot of it.
Yeah.
And like, he has a great, great line in it. I understand the view of the hound too.
Where he's basically sort of in an extended sulk, but we're told by a lot of people around him, especially the staff, and then Captain Reno, and then you have, there's so many fucking heads in this. You have, what is your man's name? He runs the Blue Parrot. Sydney Greenstreet, that great, very sort of corpulent actor. He plays Signor Ferrari that owns the Blue Parrot, which is the rival establishment. So everybody tells you about Rick, which is like that he, you know, and we learn that he had history on the side of the anti-fascist side, running guns in the Spanish Civil War. So there's a lot of stuff that there. And then obviously that like all of his staff love him so much, that you're kind of like that there's something else going on here, you know. And even there's little things like when they close Rick's with the great line that Captain Rano has, I'm shocked to discover there's gambling happening in this establishment, and then they come to go, here are your winnings. So they shut that down, and he's like, and Rick is like, the staff will all be kept on salary, you know. So like, you do kind of know he's a good guy, but you know he's in like a major sulk. And then of all the gin joints in all the world, she had to walk into mine. The person who is accompanying Victor Laszlo is Ilse Lund, played by the luminously beautiful Ingrid Bergman. And then we figure out pretty like early on there's something going on between, and she knows Sam, who is the piano player slash Rick's best friend, maybe, but also sort of his servant. And it's but they will go fishing and get drunk, apparently, according to Sam. And also he won't leave him even when he's being offered double the money to go and play in the Blue Parrot. So we know they know each other. And then we go to flashbacks of Paris on the eve of war, where they've met and they're madly in love. But it's all very, no name, no pack number. It's like, and he the more he falls in love with her, he wants to know more about her, and she won't tell him anything. And then they talk about leaving Paris together during the war. They talk about getting married. And he's waiting for her at the train station and she never comes. So then between the jigs and the reels, him and Sam, and this is where we join in, that him and Sam are in Casablanca having opened up Rick's bar, where as the title of the play, the original play goes, everybody comes to Rick's. So you have this incredible, like, rich tapestry of all the people who work there, who are all different nationalities, and then all the different people who are coming as well. And then you have them like being semi fleeced, but you're kind of paying for the privilege of being there for the ambiance, I think.
Yeah, I would 100%. I would go to Rick's 100%. I would.
It would be worth it.
Live there.
Pocket pick. It's not Ugarte. It's another, what do they call him? What an amusing little fellow. It's another guy who's going around. And there's this great scene where he bumps into one of the staff members and he immediately starts going like this to make sure that he hasn't pickpocketed him as well.
My boy in this was Captain Renner.
Oh, but he has all the best lines as well. Like, I mean, Humphrey Bogart has a few good ones as well. But he is so funny. Like, it's so light.
He is incredible. And he I'm not sure if he won, but he was nominated, I think, for Best Supporting Actor for this. But it was strange. It actually really, a lot of this, I don't know, it's just the era, but it was strange that, again, to bring up the pre-record, is when we're talking about how, you know, my movie education as a child more came from Elvis Presley movies, because that's what my mother was showing me. This actually had a lot of that in it. Where you had the thing that was and pure kind of, it's always romance in those films for me. It's like, you know, they're in a car and there's the fake background and it's like,
that, and they're driving along. Yeah,
that always feels very Elvis Presley movies to me. But also there's always a character like Captain Renault in all those kind of movies where quite debonair but corrupt figure of authority.
And that's the thing, like, he does some pretty fucked up shit, but he's intensely likable. So part of the plot here is also that so he is like the boss of Casablanca, basically, so he can sign exit visas. He won't be giving one to Victor Laszlo and Ilse Lund, because he knows the Nazis wouldn't like that. But what he tends to do is to sleep with beautiful young women and provide them with letters of transit to be able to leave. But for some reason, you're oddly not mad at him about it. I don't quite know how he does it.
It's just that absolute thing. Like, I think the answer to 9 out of 10 problems in life is charisma. Is that if you have that, you could just get away with so much. And he just has it in spades. Like, I don't know if he'd be a leading man in his own movie or whatever, because he just has that, just that great.
He's a theatre actor, I think, by training, and his father was a theatre actor, so he was one of those, you know, London families where, like, it was kind of the family business. And it is like, it looks like, obviously you have Humphrey Bogart, who's American, you have him, who's English, you have Paul Heinrich, who is Austrian, you have Ingrid Bergman, who's Swedish. Like, so it's very like matching the scene where you have this, and all of humanity is here. And like, the whole thing was a hot mess. They were rewriting it as they were going. Ingrid Bergman didn't know who she ended up with at the end of the film. They all hated Michael Curtis, the director, who all called them actor bums. So like, there, and as David said, it was based on a play that was never even staged. So like, there is really no reason that it should have, that it should be. Like, it's one of the 100, AFI's 100 films. It's got, I think, more entries in the, like, top film lines, again, in AFI thing, film quotes, than anything else. And, like, you know, there's Here's Looking at You, Kid. There's We'll Always Have Paris. This is the Beginning of a Beautiful Friendship. Play It Again, Sam, is never said.
Mm-hmm.
There's Play It, Sam. You know, I Told You Never to Play That. There is Play It Again, Sam. That's sort of a urban myth. He doesn't actually say that. Round of the Usual Suspects was the other one I was thinking
that
of.
That came from a Woody Allen theatre production of this, apparently.
Woody Allen did a theatre production of Casablanca.
I looked up, right, some things. Did not write
you make it sound like they were shady, shameful things.
But like, it's kind of like, I'm questioning this bit of trivia as well, because it said that the reason possibly why people say Play It Again, Sam, instead of Play It, Sam, is because that on this Woody Allen stage play, there's a line in it, Play It Again, Sam.
Well, there was a film he did in 1972, Play It Again, Sam. And it was about a recently divorced film critic who's urged to begin dating again by his best friend and his best friend's wife. He identifies with the 1942 film Casablanca and the character Rick Blaine, as played by Humphrey Bogart. The film is liberally sprinkled with clips from the movie and ghost-like appearances of an actor playing Bogart giving advice on how to treat women.
Did I make up the stage play?
May have.
I'm not sure. I could be wrong here, and I try not to think about Woody Allen any more than strictly necessary, but I didn't know he did theatre. I know he plays the clarinet in a jazz band, and I know obviously he's made about 10,000 films, some of them with worrying subtext.
See, what was bringing this bit of trivia into disrepute for me was like, why would more people have seen a random
Woody Allen play Woody than Allen. One of the most famous films of all time? Fair, yeah.
Yeah.
A thing that I look for in movies is consequences. I just, that's the theme that I admit is that I absolutely adore. And this movie has it in absolute spades, where so much consequences have brought these people to where they are now and have brought Rick to the person he is now. And the fact that he can, spoilers, the fact that he can let it go, I thought was just incredible.
I think there is one, so to slightly go back to our favorite debonair Cad, there is a very beautiful young woman who comes to Rick Humphrey Bogart for advice, which part of it is hilarious because she's like, he's such a boy, her fiance or her husband. They've been married for like 8 weeks, but she's like 19, you know? So, and she's basically being like, will he keep his word? You know, if I shag him, will we get these? And I'll just never tell my husband or whatever. And then the boy-like fiance is there trying to win money to be able to pay for their letters of transit. And Rick stands there and rigs the game. So he wins. And that's sort of the first moral toll that we see. There's some stuff like Rick never drinks with as Carl says, he never drinks with customers. I have never seen it. So he never does that, but then he does it with Ilsa and Victor. But like, this is sort of where you're kind of see that, and he calls him on, and Captain Rano has said it to him previously. He's like, I think at heart you're a romantic, that you have this kind of cynical front or whatever. And I think that's kind of the thing that the film turns on, if you know what I mean. Like, that's where you kind of start to see that he is somebody who might do the right thing for somebody else.
It's very much like an origin story, because obviously the whole thing, I think this is the beginning of a beautiful friendship, and you can see the goodness.
But at the end of this film, himself and the bald Captain Rano go to a Free French, which is the French rebels kind of thing. They go to a Free French camp to fight against the Nazis, basically.
Really?
Where did you think they were going?
Wait, no, who's gone there?
Humphrey Bogart and Captain Rano.
They just walk off,
yeah,
don't they?
But they say that there's a camp that they're going to go and meet up with him there, and they're like, and that's why he's like shot a Nazi. He can't stay.
Yeah. Well, that's because of that whole bit of like, they're like, did you see anything? Or like, round up the usual suspects. I thought they were just going to go off and have to crack at the bar.
Yeah, so they go to join the Free French, which is the underground.
Well, yeah,
revolution.
I noticed like, oh, there's a camp, but I didn't know they actually go on. And
yeah, well, that's where they're going away from. That's where they go from. Instead of getting on the plane, they go to join. And not that Captain Rano was ever getting on the plane. So Captain Rano has, you know, could have let them all be captured and taken away, but instead. And again, like, you know, really not condoning the predatory nature towards young, beautiful young girls. Louis, I think this could be the beginning of a beautiful friendship regarding that. Andy, you look like your mind has been blown here. David, did you get that that's what was happening? Am I being...
So, what I will say is, I'm not a history buff by any stretch of the imagination. And I know...
That's what I said coming out of 65 with Adam Driver shooting dinosaurs. I was like, do you know what? I'm not a history buff now.
But no, I know that there were two world wars. And I know who fought on which sides. But when it comes to the mechanics of it and the things like the what was Vichy French and all that, like whoosh, and like no idea what's going on there. So I definitely found the ending a little. I didn't get what you were describing there, Kate. That didn't register with me because I was just lost on all of the politics really in this movie and the why were they all going through Morocco? Like I thought it was in Europe. I definitely will admit my dumbness when it comes to the history aspect of what was going on here. I was watching the love story bit and then the other bit was slightly confusing.
I think you can always be safe in the knowledge the Nazis are the bad guys, yeah. as Peep Show has timelessly reminded us.
Yeah, no, definitely.
No, there was basically, and it, in some ways, like it's a story that is incredibly relevant because of the idea of like there was a refugee trail coming through Europe and there was only certain paths you go. Because obviously like Spain was fascist. So, you know, there was only certain ways you could get, and France was largely, again, occupied by the Nazis. So there was only so many ways to get off the continent, really, unless you, you know, had an American passport or something of that nature pre Pearl Harbor. So this was out in 1942. So I think it is in, I'm not sure, it came out in 1942, so it was like, you know, shot and filmed during World War II, which we will talk about a little bit more. I'm not sure what year it's meant to be set in. I personally feel like it's before the Americans have joined the war. That's the impression I get. And it's obviously when things are like pretty bad in terms of like wider Europe being occupied by Nazis. So there was only like very set ways you could kind of try and make your way through. This is a beautiful young girl with her boy child husband there from Bulgaria, where the devil has the people by the throat. So like there, and I think that is the thing that works about it. Because can you imagine, and you have like I said, a lot of people in this are genuinely refugees who have come from other countries. And the big irony is Conrad Veidt, who plays Strauss, the kind of chief Nazi, his wife was Jewish. And he had, again, they had fled from the Nazis. So he was a big activist, as was Paul Heinrich as well. Peter Lorre had also fled Europe. So like this was full. And the guy who plays the croupier, I think, is a French film star who had to get. So like, if you had filled this all with Americans doing weird European accents, like it wouldn't have worked. And I think the key scene where this really comes across in, which is, in case you wanted to guess, the scene that I always cry in is Le Marseillais. So, which is one of the most iconic. It's the name of the French national anthem. Stop both looking at me like that.
Cool.
So basically, in one of the most, for me, iconic and beautiful scenes in it, you have everybody comes to Rick's. So that means the Nazis do too. And they're there doing some, you know, barbarian sounding yoke and whatever. And they've taken over the piano. Rick's house band are standing around looking unhappy. And Victor Laszlo, who is a resistance leader, gets up and tells him to play the Marseillaise. And what do? They all look at Rick, and Rick goes, nods. And that's the that's the balance of power in the room. And then they start playing it with that. It is one of the all time banger anthems. So the trumpets start going, and then everybody joins in, and you have Yvonne up at the bar crying, who is one of the female, who was Rick's sort of on again, off again paramour, who he treats like shit. And there's that scene of her crying, the beautiful shot of her with her beautiful face and the tears running down. She was a French refugee. So I think you can really feel the energy of that and the realism behind it. That was what it was like. And it was like not knowing when you're on it. And again, it's probably how a lot of Ukrainian refugees are feeling now, like not knowing if you're ever going to be able to go home again. So I think so that's the scene that always makes me cry, especially if I've been at a wine tasting Casablanca screening and I've had, at that point, I would say 3.5 glasses of wine.
What was the, was Moroccan wine?
No, I think it was French and a couple of other things. I was looking forward to possibly sampling some Moroccan wine. I'm not going to lie to you, I can't remember all of the ones. Also because I'd been up till 3 a.m. the night before. This makes it sound like I have a much more debauched life than I do. This was just a coincidence. And I accidentally
You were living the Rick life.
I did the thing where like it was starting at 4 p.m. and 4:14. I brought us in at 2:00. So at that point, I had also woken Steve up at 3:00 in the morning. So I paid for lunch. I paid for a very nice French lunch in a French bistro to say I was sorry before we went to the film screening. But yeah, I think just something in particular, David, I want to talk to you about and kind of touching on that is like the use of music in this film, because you are our resident music expert as well. Like you have obviously he's doing his cute face, guys. you have obviously as time goes by, kind of running through it as a very sort of haunting. And I think even part of the reason you know it's so haunting is it is used in You Must Remember This, the incredible film history podcast that is so successful as well.
Since 1999, it's been the Warner Brothers logo music, which I could...
Oh, because it has that weird...
It goes like, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do, bum-bum-bum-bum. That's as time goes by. So that
Baby,
was...
We should get you to do that.
But yeah. It was the 75th anniversary.
When I get a bar, you're going to be my Sam.
An interesting thing about Sam...
But you're not going to have a piano.
...played by Dooley Wilson, not a piano player. Dooley Wilson was a drummer. So as you notice, you never see any close-ups on his hands.
That singing was fairly dope, Nick.
No, that's him, I think. I think that's him singing.
Oh, what?
He can't
really?
Play the piano. He can't play the piano.
I thoroughly apologize.
Yeah, no, I think he can't. Gentleman. I think that is him singing. I could be wrong, but it's not him playing the piano. So you have to kind of cut around it all the time. How did that work for you, having that as kind of a musical motif running through it? And then obviously one of the key scenes is the Marseillaise, is the use of music conveying emotion and story.
Yeah, like I definitely, the song As Time Goes By, I definitely would have picked up in the culture outside of the movie long before seeing it. Like, I think kind of if you had asked me what movie is it from, I probably wouldn't have been able to tell you, but it makes so much sense.
I think there was also and you guys might have seen this because we're all of an age, there was a Judi Dench TV series called As Time Goes By that was, you know, one of those programs that was on just a beautiful, gentle British comedy, but it was on all the fucking time.
Yeah.
I felt like it was on with it. So yeah, that's also obviously the theme for that as well, about him, her and Jeffrey Palmer were like in love during, or like, you know, had a fling during the war. I think he was a soldier, she was a nurse. And then they get together as an older couple who have had lives and kids and whatever. So that's one of the things that I remember. If you ever heard that song on TV, it was probably this intro for that.
Yeah, yeah. But it's funny, the thing, like, Andy, I don't know if it struck you to the same level, given a similar level of fandom of this franchise, but very quickly into the movie, my brain was just reading Rick's as Mos Eisley Cantina. So...
Well, there it is, right? All right.
Strap in, everyone. It's going to take a while.
Do you know what? You know what I got so much of, right? So much Indiana Jones is clearly, oh, yeah, like, those boys. I mean, like, I don't think there's a huge stretch to say. Steven Spielberg is seeing Casablanca. Like,
surprise.
Steven Spielberg has...
Yeah, one would think. If he turned around and said, my favorite film is Casablanca, I think we'd all be like, yes. Yeah, fair.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, if Steven's like... No, you're going to have to bump him now because I've already done Casablanca. If Spielberg comes and says, you know what, I want to choose Casablanca, you're like, sorry, lads. Your man who used to present Pubs of Ireland has done it instead.
Do you genuinely think I would not talk about Casablanca all over again?
Do you think that he would not know what Pubs of Ireland is?
So anyway, sorry, back to the Mos Eisley Cantina / Indiana Jones crossover.
There's so much in there, Jones. Like, clearly, like, the white, I know, like, the white jacket now is always going to be Casablanca. Big up Paul Mescal's Oscar. Look, also, when we're having the chat here, like, and but obviously Harrison Ford in that bar, in the Obi-Wan bar, he's in the white yeah, jacket. Victor Laszlo, even though he's a very good man, he looks like the, oh, I can't think of his name, you know, the baddie in the first Indiana Jones. He just has that kind of that, I know it's of another time.
Oh, your man, the other rival architect.
Yeah, who I love. He's very cool.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it's just, and of course, the Ingrid Bergman is like, obviously there was so many. In fact, I think The Last Crusade had the same first name.
Oh, is it Elsa as well?
She's Elsa, not like Elsa. ELSA, the beautiful blonde Nazi lady.
I don't like
Yeah, but then
women.
This is ILSE. But yeah, but again, one would imagine possibly a homage, although Ilsa was whatever the opposite of a Nazi is.
But yeah, no, I got strong Indiana Jones vibes.
Probably the desert thing is part of it as well.
Yeah, and it's true, because I suppose that was probably where my Star Wars leaning was probably a bit more around the Morocco Tatooine side of things.
Like
North Africa filming location stuff.
And there is this, all these reprobates and renegades, you know.
Totally, and like...
And someone does get shot also in both places,
yeah,
so...
Yeah, and the idea of the location as a place where you come to make deals or trade to get out of the place, and like,
I think
these
parallels are strong, David. I see where you're throwing down.
Look, right, I'm going to bring up Cameron Crowe here, right?
I'm
amazed we've gone 3 to 5 minutes already doing so.
My favorite non-Empire Strikes Back movie of all time is Vanilla Sky. I love it. When I can't sleep late at night, I think, who could play Tom Cruise's character from Vanilla Sky if you were making it now and Tom wasn't around? And the only man who could do that, I think, is Chris Pine. I don't know why that's so... I'm not sure about anything in life, but I'm sure that the only person who could play that role is Chris Pine.
I'm just waiting for the Chris Christopherson biopic he's clearly been practicing for the past several years.
I think that if you were... This might be, I know, this might be sacrilegious to Kate, but I think that if one was going to remake this, obviously back in the day, Harrison Ford is surely the only
100%.
Guy, and that the world wouldn't go crazy.
I'm going to throw out a slight, obviously I think maybe to a certain extent, Harrison, although God bless him with that new technology, you might have aged out of it. Pedro Pascal.
Ooh.
Shit.
Touche.
I
think that's like you're talking about a certain era as well, of like Vanilla Sky era as well.
I don't think, like, in the way that we've obviously, I think Harrison Ford in both Star Wars and Indiana Jones took inspiration from Humphrey Bogart's performance. And there's like elements that I think you can see he kind of carried in, Whereas I don't think we've seen that performance from Pedro yet, but I definitely agree that he has it in him.
And I do think too, and I'm obviously acting, but Rick has to be American for multiple reasons. Mm. And also the idea that he could leave and he doesn't.
Yeah.
That this woman broke his heart and he's been pissing and moaning in Casablanca about it during like the greatest, especially a war where, like, let's be realistic here. There was very clearly good guys and bad guys. It's not about like, oh, it's a complicated moral issue.
But although it's funny, you mentioned about the idea of remakes. I was looking at the Wikipedia article about, there's a section on remakes and unrealized sequels.
Oh, God.
There was, at the time of its release, talk of a sequel being made called Brazzaville, which is to do with, as you mentioned, the French-held city, it being kind of a follow-on of that story and them going there. And Geraldine Fitzgerald, the Irish actress, was supposed to have an important role in the sequel, but then it never actually came to be. But what I found a little bit more worrying was in 2008, Madonna was pursuing the rights to remake it in modern day Iraq. Thoughts?
Tasteful. Yeah, I'm sure nothing would have gone wrong at all. To be honest, this is the type of film that I feel like Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk, whomever, they look at themselves and they think they're Rick.
Mm-hmm.
And I would be very worried that somebody with simply enough money would just be like, you know, make it so.
To bring it back to my ignorance of history, definitely a different type of war movie.
Oh, yeah, because there's actually very little war. It's all the shadow.
Yeah, thereof. Like, you're used to seeing like Atonement, Saving Private Ryan.
It's no Womp 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 all quiet on the Western Front. Yes, I know this is World War One, but
this is politics and dealing and people drinking at a table all together, even though they don't like each other. But this is it's something that I hadn't really seen before.
I think it is the idea of, like, obviously there was the front, but there was multiple fronts, and they even make a joke of it when Yvonne is coming in drinking with the Nazi soldiers or whatever. If in her own way, Yvonne could constitute an entire second front. But so it is, yeah, the idea, we're so, as you say, familiar with life on the front lines, but it was the, like, it, what was the lights went out all over Europe, it was, and in this case extending to Morocco, but it was this specter that overhang every aspect of life for millions and millions of people that we haven't really gotten. I suppose, like, the Ukraine-Russia conflict is, or maybe the Balkans is almost the closest that we've gotten to it, but even then it probably can't match it for the sheer scale.
To get to the heartbreaking aspect of it, which is what I was expecting about it, because I was expecting a weepy, and I genuinely
wasn't
sure.
Not for people
sure
who cry at Le Marseillais, but for normal people.
you've got a heart of gold. It just is spurred on by national anthems.
And the basic knowledge of history that apparently is lacking from two-thirds of the party.
I think I went from really liking this movie to absolutely loving it right at the turn at the end, which was when they're doing the plan, when Rick is like, look, we're going to have him arrested and we're going to escape together. Captain Reynolds, who absolutely loves when Laszlo is arrested, he rubs that.
What he loves is Rick coming down to his level. That's what he really loves, I think.
Oh.
Where it's that Rick is willing to, like, get the, you know, because as we said, Captain Reno is not the moralist of men with the whole, you know, sexual harassment / assault racket he's got going on. But it's that, and he's like, you know, I'm going to see a whole new side of you, Ricky. I like it. But it's this thing.
You're very good at that.
Yeah,
I mean, I genuinely think you have a great grasp of voices.
I can't do accents at all. Pretty much the only accent I can do well is like posh British.
Old timey,
like,
film person.
Yeah, well, I live in Birmingham, which is not very posh. So it's not very useful. But also, I think with a film like Casablanca, I've seen it so many times, I know the inflections of the word. So it is like parroting stuff. But to tie just to, I think it is that he's there basically being like, I'm going to fuck over this war hero who escaped a concentration camp so I can leave with the pretty girl. And Captain Reno is like, pew, pew, pew. Yes, into it. Finger guns. Let's go. So, but also that what's always driven him mad, as I think, is Rick as this sort of, you know, iceberg. So it's that sort of thawing thing that, and also that he's down, rolling around in the dirt with everybody else, because that's what everybody is doing. Everyone is, and you touched on it earlier, everyone is scrapping to survive. Like, we all do terrible things in war, and they're not all on the front line.
It just went up 10 different levels at that point. And like I said, I was already absolutely, absolutely loving it. You know, you assume that he's going to turn, but I still wasn't 100% sure that I was like, okay, look, he might get her to the plane and send her on the plane at that point. I think he might actually send this guy back to his camp.
And I think because Bogart isn't like, let's say if the tables were turned, I don't think if it was Paul Heinrich playing that role, who is like kind of a leading man also in like Now Voyager, you wouldn't. Whereas Humphrey Bogart, like there is that duplicitous deal, you know, that he does feel like authentically can be of the dark side. And even if you see him in The African Queen, if you see him in The Maltese Falcon, like Humphrey Bogart's never an uncomplicated hero. He's never the Chris Evans, shall we say, of it, because he has too much hard living behind him for that to work.
You know, maybe in a different film that you would have seen him write Laszlo's name on the, you know, you only have to sign the signature here. You would have seen like a camera would have kind of panned it or something like that. But because none of that happened, it just played it so well. Like genuinely, like the fact that it's in a, you know, it's in a casino, it genuinely felt like revealing the cards, and I absolutely loved it. And I loved my MVP of it, my boy, I mean, look up his name here, Claude Rains. Yeah. He just played all of that, the fact that you are fucked, boy, you are drunk. And then still liked him and still got, I just thought it was, yeah, I just, that, what do you even call it, like, was it not even like third act, that final 20 minutes was just perfection.
So I'm going to interject here because I think this has become like a praise fest, but I know, David, you were not as sold on this film as Andy was, and we all know my position on this movie. So
yeah, no, obviously we were texting on Saturday last when I was watching it then, and I now admittedly I had just come home from a raw onion eating contest, so my powers of perception.
You've come home from winning a raw onion eating contest,
thank
listeners.
You, thank you.
Very
yeah.
key.
With my golden onion garland around my neck, but the film is one that I can undoubtedly
just leave that there. I like that. You're just moving on.
There's no need.
Let the context be buried. Let the context be buried. What else do you need?
It's a film that I can undoubtedly acknowledge the merits of, and like visually it has some like for something made in the early 40s, like the cinematography is stunning in moments, and like it's absolutely amazing cast, visually great music, all of that, but I just wasn't hooked. And I think like part of it is, I know back in season one we were talking about Unforgiven and westerns and my kind of like hesitation around
about that. Really like that film. Anyway, yeah. Moving on.
But it was, I kind of similarly with my hesitation around the western genre, war stuff like World War II, World War One stuff in general, again, wouldn't be stuff that I'm madly drawn to. Funnily, I did love All Quiet on the Western Front, Womp Womp Womp, as you mentioned earlier.
I have to stop doing that. No one has seen it, but like the Womps are very key.
Very
and
key.
The Womps won an Oscar.
The Womps won an Oscar, absolutely. But I did love that, which was a complete like out of character for me.
Which is funny because it is in some ways very typical war film. Like they're in the trenches, there is war. And as Andy said, this is in some ways not a typical war film.
Exactly.
Because you are away from the fighting at all the time. So it's interesting to me because your dislike of war films is something that we've talked about, and your refusal to let me do Lord of the Rings in this podcast. And we agree about pretty much everything else. So it is interesting to me how much you did like All Quiet. Now, obviously, the All Quiet in the Western Front, as we said, is very good. We're not saying it's not good, but I wouldn't have, if you had asked me,
well, I think
if you would like it.
But
I would
in terms
have
of having
now.
To contextually understand the war, I don't think All Quiet on the Western Front required you to actually come in with a huge amount of prior knowledge. It showed you war and the absolute brutality of it all, kind of thing. That my completely hands up, willing to admit, like lack of knowledge. I gave up history at the junior cert gladly, and I did not want to pursue it any further. But the fact that I didn't have context around what was going on and why things were in Casablanca, I think I came into the film with a little bit of a like, oh, what's going on here? Frustration that.
So I'm going to guess you guys didn't find the little explainer that they do at the start sufficient.
No,
I have that open in another window here because I thought I better watch that again.
And I know you see it at the start of the film. I'm not being funny, and then you move into so much different action and whatever. It's like hard to keep the geopolitical context that was outlined.
Well, yeah, it starts with a podcast. That was I was really excited about.
Yeah, no, it's contextually. I felt like I was coming in without the right information to appreciate the dynamics. As I said, the love story part, you could understand that without any prior knowledge. I'm like, oh, they met in Paris before. Oh, this is what happened.
I think we all fell in love with Ingrid Bergman throughout the course of this film.
Totally. But everything that happened around the political aspect of it was just, went over my head. And I just wasn't... I think that was what prevented me from getting hooked into it.
I get what you mean, because when I say it's a different type of war movie, it's so relaxed. It's like, even though you know these people are getting killed, but it is kind of like so kind of relaxed in its dealings of certain things where, like, you know, like I said, like, oh, this is, you know, he was, you know, he escaped from the concentration camps and he's sitting down.
And looking great, might I add. Yeah,
looking incredible. But like they're in a bar with Nazis. And I know that's because what's the other option? This is all part of the way they have to do business. This is another part.
It's the dance.
As Goldman said, this is another way of doing battle.
And the fact that it was made in the height of the war. Like, this isn't a film that's like made in the 50s where they have all the retrospect and they're kind of like slotting a story in, like
gentlemanly warfare. You do kind of step back from that. If you did not have a clue about this, and clearly, you know, Arklow, CBS, like, I can't blame them, I just didn't pay attention.
But I will say, it's probably not an area, just, even when we, if in school and we're studying World War II, I think North Africa is sort of, yeah, like you've got, you know, Rommel and Monty and whatever, and it is sort of just like glossed over a little bit as well. Like, World War II is,
it's fighting in Europe, it's bombs, it's, you know, it's Battle of Britain, it's that kind of thing, you know. It isn't dealings over, I wish it was, jeez, I would have probably, I could be a doctor now if it was. It's dealings over card tables and whiskey.
But I think there is that idea as well, that like the wheels of war grind slow as well. And especially, like, we live in an era, obviously, where, like, it's constant news and constant updates. But, like, you only very vaguely had an idea what was going on anywhere.
That is genuinely something that I did think about. Actually, I was watching it. I was like, oh, yeah, this kind of, because this feels different. It's because, like, yeah, look, it wasn't, because that's an arsehole thing to say, like, it wasn't kind of like, you know, like, rations and fighting. There had to be Tuesdays and there had to be Wednesdays as well, like, you know?
And there is also an element, just kind of going back to what you guys we're talking about as well, like, and we have talked about this before, this idea with modern films where, like, everything is exposition out the wazoo and your hand is held and explained to you. There is an element, they do the podcast explainery bit with a little map and everything at the start, they do that, but they also don't, like, tell you what the Free French is. They don't tell, you know, like, they
exactly,
so there isn't really, it's all such character work. Like, there isn't really any, I'm just going to take a beat here and explain the geopolitical situation. Like, that doesn't happen in a way that it probably would be shoehorned into modern films. So did you guys get that he was, like, you know, going to resistance meetings and stuff, and there was the guy with the secret ring and all of that business? You're both staring at me.
The secret ring, I understood that something was communicated there between their kind of underground kind of stuff. But
100%.
Yeah, so that was like the underground network. And Carl, who was possible. It's hard to pick, you know, a favourite staff member of Rick's, because they're all so great. Like, you've Sasha the Mad Russian behind the bar, and you've the French creep here, and you've Carl, who I think is like German or Austrian maybe, who is like the sort of head of front of house, maitre d'. You Sam, so you have all of these great characters. But and even like when Carl's like, I'm going to the meeting, and Humphrey Bogart's like, don't tell me, I don't want to know.
So I got the ring and I said that, but Rick wasn't doing that.
Rick knew all of this was happening. Good, bad and indifferent, and as you say, just, like, Nazis in the bar, as much as
I understand the view of the hand, which again, I think it's just such a, like, the text for this, I'd actually would love to read the poem.
And like I said, the thing that I think is so interesting, like, it is one of the great scripts. This was written by 7 different people. This was a hot fucking mess. They all left it thinking it was a dog's dinner because it was wild and because Michael Curtis was an arse and, like, things were changing all the time and it was being rewritten on the spot. But yet it is one of the great scripts with arguably more, like, line for line bangers than, like, I mean, I challenge you to find me a film with more better one liners, and especially that we still use, like, that we name films after, you know, like, well, I'm thinking of The Usual Suspects and the Play It Again Sam thing, you know. So it is interesting how, like I always say, and especially
Even clock The Usual Suspects thing there, you know.
In work, the, you know, a camel is a horse built by committee is what I say a lot, because when it gets to the point that I have to consult like 20 people to do something, but yet something, some weird alchemy made this work, and I don't know what it was, and I think if you tried to do it again, you couldn't.
And of all, as someone who is a master, and this is so, this has played, obviously you love this movie a lot, and then obviously it has played a lovely role recent relationships, but I don't know why I'm trying to be subtle and delightful about that.
I feel like you're doing it This Is Your Life for me, which after things that have happened recently on this podcast, I wouldn't be shocked.
Of all those iconic lines, you know, if you were going to put one as the name of your biography, what would it
I mean,
be?
Like, Will Always of Paris is pretty good, but also like there's titles.
So good. You think I would not buy Kay McAvoy, Will Always of Paris.
But then the other one I love, and it's not so much like, it's not as like Round Up the Usual Suspects is obviously great. I think it's the beginning of a beautiful friendship, is a great biography opener. But the thing, one of the ones I like, so that's good, less like soundbitey or whatever, is when, and we're kind of getting to the point of like breaking down the ending a little bit. So just to say, they're all at the airfield. These signed letters of there's these signed letters of transit that all that remains is for the names to be filled in. We are meeting at the airfield with Captain Reno, Rick, Humphrey Bogart, with Ilse Lund, with Victor Laszlo, and the Nazis are on the way, and who's getting on the plane? And Ilse Lund thinks she's leaving with Humphrey Bogart because they have they've rekindled their love from Paris and whatever. And he says to her that you're getting on that plane with him because if you don't, you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of your life. So yeah, that one I love. And I really reined in my Humphrey Bogart delivery there.
And actually, now I'm going to probably get a little bit weepy here because I said I love consequences and things, is that I love the idea that unknowns to that person, or that person could not have any intention or will to do it or be trying to do it, but that I genuinely, this isn't a big thing to say, but like, people make you better in your worst moments. People make you better. The people around you make you better. And it's that lovely, 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 and I'm not even going to remember it per line for line, but his reason for telling her to get on that plane was like, because you make him better, and he'll need you, and the world needs him.
Yeah,
and that is the most beautiful thing I have ever.
It's a sacrifice
heard.
For a greater good, and I think just to kind of touch on our central love triangle of these three characters, I think, like as we said at length, Humphrey Bogart is iconic in it. Every man wants a white dinner jacket and to be Rick, but Victor Laszlo, like, you can't root against the man. And that Marcy A scene, I think, really helps with that, because you're like, this is a leader of men. This is somebody who is not afraid. This is somebody who's putting it all out in the line as well. So you're not kind of like, fuck him, leave him, what a jerk, how boring, what NASA, or because that will be the easier route. And then when you look at Ilse, you're not mad at her either, because so basically she leaves Humphrey Bogart standing on the railway platform, because what happened was she met him when she was very young and he was a hero and whatever, and they fell in love and he went off and he got captured in the concentration camp. She was told he was dead, and then she, you know, starts this relationship with Humphrey Bogart and is very like, I don't want to talk about my past, which is kind of understandable in this, and also like at that time nobody wanted to talk about their past, you know. And then as they're due to meet, she gets word that he is in fact alive and has been smuggled to Paris and is injured, sick and injured, in a railway carriage, you know, or somewhere. So she has to go to him. So like, you can't be angry at anybody, or you're not really rooting against anybody. And like, I think that's what makes it a great film. And also there is, like, we're not in a world where you could pick up a phone and be like, Soz babes, TTL. Like, you know, this isn't the kind of world that we're living in as well. So I think that's what makes it work, where, like, even if we might have wanted them to end up together, we can see where they didn't, and you don't really feel cheated by it.
And you know what I really love, and it's a lovely little bit of cleanup, and it just shows you how clever he is that he... whether Laszlo believes him or not, I don't think he does. But Rick just does that little bit of cleaning up at the end, where he's just like, look, she came here, it was because of you.
Yeah, and she tried to seduce me to get the thing, whatever.
Yeah, it just completely just...
if that was ever going to come up down the future, it's not going to come up. Yeah.
And he touched on it earlier also, because when he's asking her, like, kind of, who is this guy? He is a bit like, you know, I don't expect you to have, like, remained chaste or whatever. Like, they do kind of touch on it a bit as well. Like, I don't think, he doesn't believe her that they, you know, that they weren't involved in Paris as well. But he also doesn't hold it against her because, again, she thought he was dead.
Maybe this is an unfair question, but who do you think is her, like, great love? Now, we can have more than one love in life, obviously, but who do you think is her?
Because I think the trick, we only get a really brief glance of who Rick was in Paris, whereas we get an extensive glance of the sort of morose, bitter man that he is in Casablanca. And then she does touch on it, you know, that that we got Paris back. We'd lost it, but we got it back last night. So, like, we actually don't really know, like, other than that he is deep down, he's very, as you said, he's an incredibly charismatic man. He is deep down a good guy. We don't actually know Ilse's Rick, really, if you think about it.
Actually, now that you mention it, it's that line that, you know, we'll always have Paris, that gets thrown around. Yeah.
But it's any, like, you know, we will always have the Elysium Fields, like, we'll always have this moment in time. Is what it, and, like, you know, if that moment in time happened to have taken place in Paris, great. But it is this idea.
But I think that it may be, I'm being unfair. I think it could be a thing that a dickhead would say to, I mean, not if it's like,
as he's breaking up with somebody.
Yeah. It's a kind of a thing that, like, because they think that's what that line in the movie is, like, oh, look, we'll always have Funderland Christmas 20.
Forget it, Jake. 2018. It's Chinatown. Yeah.
If you just, like me, you just heard the quotes, you hadn't seen the film, you hadn't seen the context, I would have thought that that was it. It's like, ah, we'll always have Paris kind of like thing. But actually, it's that line which I think makes it beautiful. It's like, we didn't, but we got it back. Yeah. It's like, it's actually, it doesn't matter if you have Paris, it matters if you have it now, kind of.
But it's also the moment in time on the eve of great war and destruction. And, like, so it's a time, it's a place, but it's also a time in history and in their lives as well.
Chiss is so beautiful. And you know what? Yes, you know what I still would do if I was a teacher? I would love to see this in a secondary school play.
So who told me they did?
Not primary school. Sorry, secondary school would be weird. Yeah. Primary school play. I would love to see a bunch of kids, one kid in the white jacket, the other.
Somebody rafting dry ice from beside the piano.
Yeah. Like, if any teachers listen to this, I was going to say I'll sponsor it. I won't do that.
Let's not get ahead of it. We need a few more patients.
I will buy a ticket to the production.
Yeah, we'll go and see it.
I will wish you well if you do a primary school play of Casablanca.
I mean, sold. My sister actually, I think it was because someone was telling me, and I didn't see, other than wedding venues, I didn't see that many people over the weekend. So I think it was my younger sister said that they did this for The Leaving, which I have, it was definitely not on the curriculum. And she's 6 years younger than me. So for...
Well, there's definitely a bang of Leaving Cert often. Like I said, like I did Third Man.
Yeah, so I definitely wasn't on Mice. We had Of Mice and Men for the book, and then we'd Cinema Paradiso for the film, which also, if anyone wants to come on and talk about Cinema Paradiso, we can definitely do that. Anyway, but yeah, so I think it is in a senior school curriculum, but you just want to see tiny children in the fog in trench coats.
I just want to see a white jacket. I just want to see a little dude in a white jacket. And, like, it could be... And the little tables. I always love seeing... You know what I always love seeing? Kids gamble.
Are you a big fan of Bugsy Malone? That.
We need to. Can we do another episode here? Because I don't think I've ever seen.
Yeah, I've never. I have seen it, but I saw it when I was a kid, and I don't remember anything about it other than the splat guns, like the.
Yeah, like the premise of kids trying to be adorable, irritates me. But naturally adorable kids knocking off lines of Casablanca sounds like a treat.
Right. Yeah, I think you've really given us food for thought there at the end. So I think we probably end our film portion on that note, unless anyone has any other notes that they want to throw out there, because I should be stopped, basically. And this seems like Andy's weird school play construct seems to be as good a point to do it as any.
The one last bit is we usually ask our guests what film.
Of course.
Yeah, I've got like 10. Yeah, this is the part
when
I've been looking forward to.
When we first asked Andy to do this, his first response was to think about what film he was going to recommend that people see. And
yeah,
I
don't even mind. Okay. So yeah, we usually ask our guests, what film... Obviously, we are the last one to see, but what film would you recommend other people to see that you think is underseen?
I did have two of them until watching this movie. So I'm going to get the original two out that I've been kind of like sitting in a corner thinking, like trying to will into like Richie's head and stuff. I was like, go on, mention this movie. If you want this weekend, if you were thinking like this, if you want to not to date this podcast, if you want to celebrate 3 years after the pandemic, if you want to celebrate that fact, you would like, do you know what? I would love to relive the days of a pandemic. Two beautiful, heartbreaking films that I don't think enough people have seen, and they just both tend to have a pandemic as a backdrop of it, but they involve memories and sense and why that's so important to us. And is first up is Perfect Sense with Ewan McGregor, which is, you know, you'd say to somebody, think like, that sounds absolutely terrible, but it is the most special, heart-wrenching but also heartwarming film. It's Ewan McGregor and Eva Green play, he's a chef, she's an epidemiologist, and it's in Glasgow. And a pandemic is spreading the world completely, like, on the news and stuff like that, where you're losing senses. So the entire world first loses taste, and then they lose smell, and then they lose touch. And it's getting, obviously things are getting worse and worse and worse as it goes on. But you also have these two absolutely falling in love. And it is just beautiful, and it does these odd little weird little things where there's voiceover explaining, just not even kind of explaining, kind of a very kind of like arty little touch where it says when the world lost its taste, this and this and this, and it's just all about the beauty of it. And it just does a lovely, it's just a very, very lovely, it sounds the most horrifying movie ever, but also Little Fish, which is a movie I only seen recently, but it's very much of that ilk where a pandemic is hitting and people are losing their memories, and it's the importance of memories. And it's, again, it's a romance, and it's Olivia Cooke, who is the Ingmar Bergman of her day. So Little Fish and Perfect Sense. But also, this is my Casablanca pick, is because I love that driving montage so much, and that kind of like slick kind of comedy delivery you only really saw in the 60s, is Down With Love. Ewan McGregor, Renée Zellweger rom-com made of that ilk. Like, it's all fake backgrounds, it's all kind of swinging, it's all quick fire dialogue. People hated it. It made about €2, but I absolutely love it. So there you go. If you want to be absolutely miserable and heartbroken about pandemics, go for the other two. If you just want a nice time,
a menu to choose from.
I can rest out, I can sleep. I've gave the movies that I wanted to pick on this podcast.
But, and Kate, what would you recommend in the vein of what we're talking about?
I think like at the end of the day, the totemic presence in Casablanca is Humphrey Bogart. I think he is someone that is probably due for a little bit of a re-examination. So I would say, if you want to kind of get a sense of Humphrey Bogart, you could start with The Maltese Falcon, which is his film noir. He's playing Sam Spade, detective, the originator of the sort of MacGuffin thing. Then move on to Have and To Have Not, which is the film that he met Lauren Bacall, his wife, on, with The Immortal. You know how to whistle, don't you, Steve? You just put your lips together and blow. And then I would finish with The African Queen, the film that he won his Oscar for, made with the late, great Katharine Hepburn. And you've moved into Technicolor in that as well, which also said, she wrote a fucking great book about it, The African Queen, or How I Went to How I Got Lost in Africa and Almost Lost My, How I Went to Africa and Almost Lost My Mind. Because they were like, what they went through, and there may well be an actual filmed documentary about it, but if there is, I don't know. What they went to make this film could be a film in its own right. So I found that in a secondhand bookshop like years ago. And other than, I think I had seen Casablanca, but I think I got that book when I was quite young. It was probably one of the one of like kind of my introductions into like this type of film. The director is John Huston, and all he wanted to do was go and hunt things. He just wanted to shoot shit, like the type of thing that we see pictures of the internet of white men with guns standing over and get very annoyed about. But yeah, I would say there is a lot of other stuff in there. There, like, The Big Sleep is probably the biggest one that I've left off. But I would say, if you wanted to look at his like the film noir and Tragedy of Sierra Madre, but the film noir phase, the start of one of the greatest love stories and iconic pairings in Hollywood, and then The African Queen, for which he got his Oscar, and he kind of moved into where he is. He's the exact opposite of being suave and debonair. The African Queen is the name of the boat that he owns and works on, and it's basically like a bathtub with a boiler in it. Like, it's that kind of thing. And Charlie Allnut is, like, very much the roughest and readiest of men. So, yeah, if anyone wanted to follow this trail and have a little bit more Humphrey Bogart in their lives.
That was the movie that I think Breida was trying to mention to me when we were trying to figure out other Humphrey Bogart movies. Breida goes, oh, he was in a boat with someone, wasn't he?
In a boat, so. Probably with the person who remains the most successful Oscar-winning actress of all time, Ms. Catherine Hepburn. Yeah. And incidentally, if you want to read any of her books or any interviews with her, I think especially as she got older, like, that woman, she does not give a shit. Now, some of it obviously is...
It sounds great, actually, the book.
Some of it is myth-making, I think, especially around her and Spencer Tracy, and she also, like, outlived everybody and lived forever. But she was a when I say she loved a bitch, I don't mean it in a bad way, because I think that's what makes great biography or whatever, and she had some great... What was the one she had about Annette Bening and Warren Beatty? They were at some party together and they left and whatever, and she goes, poor girl, and someone says, oh, they seem very much in love, and they go, and she goes, yes, they both are, with the same man, because Warren Beatty was so up his own arse, like, you can't really argue with that. And she also, this is one of her nominations for Oscar, she didn't win, but didn't hold her back, because she won she won like four other times. But yeah, it's, well, she is brilliant in it as well, so that's why we're watching.
I will 100% watch it, actually. Genuinely, I will 100% watch
it. I think
it.
I have it on DVD, because I think I have a lot of Bogart DVDs. So, yeah, I think that pretty much...
I don't get my recommendation, do I?
Oh, sorry, Dave. Sorry. I don't know why I thought you had done one before me.
You were playing fast and late at the system.
I got home at midnight last night, and it is now 22:11. It's been a long few weeks. A long but delightful few weeks. So, David, apologies. Go for it.
65. Yeah.
Well, I'm actually tailoring my recommendation a bit more to the guest than the movie for this one, I have to say. So I've long, I don't know if the guest has got around to seeing this. I know I've long plugged it to him. It's Come On, Come On. It was released in late 2021. Joaquin Phoenix is in it, playing a podcaster, recording interviews with kids all around the US about their hopes for the future. And he is landed with the responsibility of taking care of his nephew, and has brilliant performances from also Gabby Hoffman, who plays his sister in it, and child actor Woody Norman, who you would not believe is English, given how perfectly he nails the American accent of the kid he's playing. It's also, the soundtrack is done by Aaron Dessner and Bryce Dessner of The National. I can see the fist pump going up from
Did
Andy
somebody
there.
Somebody make this film for Andy.
Yeah. And similar to Kate's tears being shed from La Marseillaise, when I was watching the trailer again for this recently, I literally started crying from the music in it. So if you want a good, like, hits you in the feels, beautiful, like, emotional journey about podcasting and the love of being an uncle, I can't recommend it more.
To give you credit, I started it recently and I stopped it after 5 minutes because I knew I was going to be on my phone, and I was like, you know what? This is not the movie to do that. This is not, this is the 11:30 at night when I have to charge my phone on that thing.
I love that you can start a film at 11:30 at night. I'm asleep at 11:30 at night, and it's 10:45 now, and I should definitely be.
You are. Yeah,
I think the bags under my eyes have actually increased as we've been talking about this. So I think all that remains is for me to apologize to David for running like wild and loose with our very key happen all the time slots. I don't know what it was. He was clearly been carried away by the emotion of Casablanca. And say, guys, where can people find you on the internet?
I'm like the shift that essentially. It's Promenade. Listen to Promenade. Like, my Instagram and Twitter presence is non-existence. Hi, Andy Gaffney, if you want occasionally me to retweet something about The National. But
and if you're lucky, he might slide into your DMs and ask you, have you ever wanted to make a podcast?
And you know what you discover? You discover friendship.
Aww.
And you discover that the person you ask has a friend who had literally days before been like, I've had a great idea for a podcast.
The timing was like very much.
It was really, it was genuinely quite, I remember getting back onto David because I think as we discussed on a different podcast, or it might've been one of our patron ones, we had already kind of talked about maybe doing a podcast around like, and we planned it out, and actually, no, maybe we didn't mention a podcast. Maybe we mentioned it to you.
Oh no, we were talking on the group WhatsApp, the three of us. about a previous podcast about the Irish dating scene that the pair of us were going to put together 2 years prior to when what started as The Last One to See.
When David came up with the greatest elevator pitch for a podcast of all time. So yeah, it was very, very, very serendipitous. But I have to also add the disclaimer that just if you follow, just following Andy on Twitter does not guarantee that he will ask you to make a podcast for The Shift. T's and C's apply. And David, where can people find you on the internet?
I am at David P. Fitz on Instagram, Twitter, and Letterboxd. And Kate?
I'm Kate Mack on Twitter and Instagram. And you can also follow us on The Last One to See at all of the things. I particularly encourage you to check out David's sterling work on our Letterboxd. And I even more encourage you to sign up for our Patreon episode. We just this week dropped our Oscar reaction. So yeah, that was really fun to record. So you'll get all the bonus content. And as we have attempted to keep our intros and outros and indeed episodes shorter, this may be not an episode that it succeeds with, because I think we are in fact approaching the running time of Casablanca, which as mentioned is not a 3 hour epic, Lawrence of Arabia epic. You can fit it in very pleasantly of a Friday evening.
Saturday morning after you watch the card.
I mean, just follow your heart, and your heart apparently is very involved with Adam Driver and dinosaurs. I don't know what movie that is, by the way. I've been confused for this whole podcast. And we are back. We have returned from Casablanca. Andy forever changed. David, possibly not. Yeah, still consistently insane. I mean, so I think that's probably where we're at after our journey in the Moroccan desert.
Yeah, I'm glad to have like filled that blind spot in what I didn't even realize was a blind spot in my cinematic viewing history.
I feel lots of cultural, as you say, throwbacks now have renewed sense. So moving swiftly on, although as much as it pains me to leave, we are both very excited about the next ep that we have lined up. David, tell us all.
Yes, so for the next one, we're going to have Graham Smith, who is a friend of mine. And you may know from his work on RTE, he has a show on 2XM on Thursday nights called Painted Flowers. And he also produces on Jennifer Zamparelli's show. Their words.
Jennifer is good, though. I like that.
So I know Graham from also DJing around Dublin. We have done the Dublin Record Club stuff together. So how fitting that the movie we will be covering with him is to do with music and records. It's Empire Records.
A stone cold banger full of mainly the women, actually, who at the very start of their careers. The soundtrack is amazing. We won't go into it too much because obviously we'll talk about it in the episode. But yeah, a great pick from Graham, and I'm very excited to revisit it.
Also coming is Andy's project that he's been feverishly working on over the past couple of weeks to get edited and ready. It is the second season of Promenade coming at the end of April.
The award-winning Promenade. So yeah, we're very excited. We are biased, but it's a beautiful thing. And that's not just because he will probably listen to this podcast. And then also in terms of further content, we will be doing a Patreon episode. So yeah, please do subscribe to The Last One to See Patreon. If there is anything else that you'd like us to discuss, you can hit us up on the socials. And what would socials would they be, David?
We are on Twitter, Letterboxd, and Instagram at The Last One to See.
And where can the good folks on the internet find you?
I am at David P. Fitz on the three aforementioned social networks. And you?
Not a Letterboxd person, but I am on Twitter and Instagram at I'm Kate Mack. We would love to hear from you. But until then, David, who is, as I'm going to squeeze this in the end, who has agreed to be my bridesman?
Well, I have indeed. I look forward to taking on the duties of bride's attendancy.
We're not really sure what that will entail. Who knows? I'm not sure I'm going to be very good at being a bride, and you've never been a bridesman.
Yeah, this is my first time being part of the royal court of brides people.
As you know, I am most regal and queen-like, so. But yeah, no, it'll be grand. It's going to be a really good party, we think.
What we're a fan of.
It's how we roll. So yeah, delighted to have him on board for that. So yeah, I guess we'll always have Paris, and it's time to wrap it up.